From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. An aide to Vice President Mike Pence is the latest person to testify in the impeachment inquiry today. Jennifer Williams listened in on President Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president, in which Trump asked the Ukrainian leader to do him a favor and investigate Joe Biden and his son. Her testimony comes as Democrats are releasing transcripts of testimony taken so far ahead of the start of public hearings with witnesses next week. Joining us now is Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And before we get to what's happening today, we have to note that President Trump is calling you and your two co-authors of a story out today, low-life reporters. The story said that Trump wanted Attorney General William Barr to hold a news conference to say that Trump broke no laws in that July 25th phone call and that Barr declined to hold that news conference. First of all, what is it like to be called out on Twitter by the president by name? And do you stand by your story?
The personal reaction is more of a professional one. You know, I'll have to explain this to my children at home today that I am not a lowlife. I also want to, in all seriousness, say that the colleagues that I work with at The Washington Post are some of the most relentless, dogged, careful, rigorous reporters I've ever had the pleasure to be with, and we stand entirely by our story.
Well, and we can vouch for the fact that you're not a lowlife as well. Carol, Jennifer Williams, the person testifying today, is a career Foreign Service officer in European and Russian affairs. Is she testifying voluntarily, and what might she tell lawmakers?
She is testifying, in a sense, voluntarily. I mean, she's not trying to go to court to prevent the subpoena from being served. She is an important witness, Jeremy, significant, as each one is for different reasons. But in her case, she can testify to any kind of early alerts that the vice president received about both this call, which she listened to, and other events prior to July 25th. Remember, she's listening in not only as an expert, but as someone who's supposed to keep the vice president briefed and apprised of big developments. And our understanding is that she does flag this call and raise concerns about it, raise a flag about it, let me say it
that way.
Maybe
to the vice president.
Well, we'll see. I think I shouldn't get too far ahead of my skis, but she does raise concerns about this call.
What about former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who was a no-show for his testimony today? I know you have broken a story today about whether he might actually testify and what he'd be likely to say.
Yes. The story has three key components to it that are all pretty nuanced and complicated, but quickly – what we reported is that John Bolton, the departed national security advisor to the president, who often tussled with him on foreign policy and certainly did on Ukraine, wants to testify if a court approves it. He does not want to be prevented, essentially, by the White House from testifying under the argument that he's a senior White House advisor whose confidential conversations are always under some blanket cloak of privilege. And also he has information that sources tell us is damaging to the president. He is expected to corroborate key National Security Council aides and other career public servants who said he was alarmed about this pressure on Ukraine to announce an investigation and very disconcerted about withholding aid to the country as a kind of bargaining chip, and that he himself will corroborate their accounts of that sort of, again, red flag that he raised multiple times.
The testimony of another key witness, Acting Ambassador William Taylor, was released yesterday. What stands out to you from the transcript release so far?
Well, first off, in a very general way, Ambassador Taylor comes across as the epitome and the soul of public servant, you know, just absolutely focused on what's best for the country, the mission of why we care about Ukraine as an ally, why we want to protect them from Russian aggression, and why that's of strategic national importance to the United States. Ukraine is this bloc in between Russia and Europe, and we want to support them. But the second thing that stands out to me, Jeremy, is the testimony itself. Separate and apart from what we learned from leaks earlier on when he did testify, we now see more tour of Ambassador Bolton. Bolton telling people he did not want this July 25th call to go forward, predicted it was going to be a disaster, raised and expressed deep concerns about the State Department officials who were upset about the withholding of aid and trying to get that aid back on track in his own sort of, behind the scenes machinations.
Just briefly, 30 seconds left here. What do you think are the risks for both sides of the public hearings that are supposed to start next week?
Oh, wow. So many risks. I mean, one is that you have a witness who you think is going to say what you want to hear and then provide some exigency. As a reporter, I'm dying to hear all of it, no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. But I think that the Democrats have a stake in having a particular narrative come across. Mm-hmm. The same for Republicans. The risk is that somebody will come out and say, you know, I'm a Republican, per our description of Bolton. Mm-hmm. I'm a Republican, and this really troubled me. That's going to be a problem for Republicans.
Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig, thank you so much, as always.
Of course.
And staying with politics, the Democrats, hoping to win their party's nomination for president, represent the most diverse field in history. And along with age, race, and sexual orientation, they also have a broad range of religious and spiritual beliefs. New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman reports that as they campaign across the state, some candidates are talking about those beliefs in ways Democrats usually don't.
Before Bernie Sanders took the podium in the town of Hooksett, New Hampshire last month, Reverend Janai Rosick, minister in the United Church of Christ, addressed the crowd.
And I've come here to briefly talk about something that feels, I think for a lot of us, a little taboo. Religion and politics. Ooh.
Taboo, at least for most Democrats. For the past 50 or so years in America, openly blending faith and politics has largely been the domain of the religious right. But Rosick told the audience that it's time for the religious left to also raise its voice, that everyone bears the responsibility of helping the marginalized.
It doesn't matter what faith tradition you come out of, or no faith tradition at all. It matters that we care about our world and each other.
How candidates talk about that responsibility on the stump varies. Some, like South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, make their faith a central theme.
I'm pretty sure God doesn't belong to a political party, and if he did, I can't imagine it would be the one that's in charge of the White House today.
Another candidate, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, seamlessly quotes Bible verses and talks about faith as a driving force in his life.
So I'm one of these people that says, before you tell me about your religion, you should show it to me in how you treat other people. And there's a very big value in my faith that is in Matthew 25 about I was in prison and you visited me.
And this expression of religious faith isn't just from Christian candidates. The 2020 field includes less represented religions in America, candidates that in decades past may have downplayed their religion, such as Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard.
I took my oath of office on the Bhagavad Gita when I was first sworn into Congress in 2012. I'm a practicing Hindu, and my spiritual practice, my relationship with God, is something that is near and dear to my heart.
So what's changed? Why are some Democrats working hard to highlight their religious values? Dartmouth religion professor Randall Balmer says it's in part a reaction to what progressives see as the moral failings of President Trump.
I think Americans in 2020, just as they did in 1976 and again in 2000, are looking for what I call a redeemer president. That is, we're looking for a candidate for president who has a moral compass.
In 76, the sour aftertaste of Watergate helped push a religious Democrat, Jimmy Carter, to the White House. In 2000, with the scandals of the Clinton administration still fresh, George Bush, a born-again Christian, spoke frequently about his religious convictions. Balmer says Democrats are appalled by the Trump administration's policies, and candidates would be smart to position themselves as ethical antidotes.
Frankly, I've been astonished that more of the Democratic candidates for the nomination have not been speaking this language of faith and morality in talking about their politics.
But is that a smart strategy in New Hampshire? It's a state that routinely ranks last in religious participation, how often people go to church or pray. Susan Hocking of Walpole identifies as an atheist. She recently attended an Elizabeth Warren event decked out in a T-shirt with an image from The Handmaid's Tale, a book about a dystopian theocracy.
You can be whatever you want to be, just don't force it down my throat.
But other Democrats at the Warren event seem okay with more open displays of faith from their candidates. Alison Bluen from Keene just wants it backed up by action.
I'd like to see spirituality talked about on more than a book level, more than a big guy in the sky level. I would like to see people talk to about spirituality in a way to connect to other human beings on this earth.
Some candidates this cycle are talking about their own forms of spirituality while skewing away from traditional religious descriptions. And then there is Marianne Williamson, an author whose works are often found in the spiritual section of bookstores. Her stump speech is sprinkled with language about consciousness and unseen forces.
And we see that negatively with this president. It's traumatizing. The chaos in his mind is traumatizing. And the peace in the next president will be very healing.
Spiritual healing isn't a typical Democratic talking point, but the 2020 candidates may be wise to offer voters someone they can believe in. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
You may have noticed that articulate 9-year-old boy speaking with Elizabeth Warren at CNN's LGBTQ town hall meeting last month.
My name is Jacob, and I'm a 9-year-old transgender American. Uh-huh. My question is...
All right, Jacob. Hold on.
What will you do in your first week as president to make sure that kids like me feel safer in schools? And what do you think schools need to do better to make sure that I don't have to worry about anything but my homework?
Oh, I like that question, Jacob.
Jacob's pride and his confidence lit up the place, but it wasn't always that way. You might remember we first spoke to his mom, Mimi LeMay, 4 years ago. So Jacob was 5, and she'd just written a blog, a letter to my son Jacob on his 5th birthday, detailing her family's struggle to understand that they had a son, not a daughter, and Jacob's struggle, starting before his 3rd birthday, to tell them that. Mimi was one of the first parents of transgender children to speak out, and there were those who couldn't believe a 3-year-old could even know what gender was. We'll post her letter at hereandnow.org. Read it, and then brace yourself for Mimi LeMay's forthcoming book, What We Will Become, in which she braids Jacob's story with her own. Because while he was struggling to claim the boy he knew he was, she was plunged into memories of trying to be the girl she knew she could be, a girl suppressed by an ultra-Orthodox Jewish community that taught her a woman was not as important as the man she needed to marry. And Mimi LeMay joins us in our studios. Mimi, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin. It's wonderful to be back.
Boy, we had no idea about your storyline. We were following Jacob's. We say right off, you ask Jacob, there's a moment in the book where you ask him, should we tell people about this? And he was, yes. And you also, we presume, talked to his dad, your husband Joe, Jacob's sisters, about writing this book. But take us back to those who might say, this is impossible. How could anyone 1, 2, 3 years old know that there's something wrong with the body they're in? What were you seeing?
What we were seeing was a child who had been very happy up till a certain point, about 2.5 years old, and suddenly, almost as if the source of energy was being turned down for him, he started to become angry, almost to display some what we would call like OCD-type behavior, very anxious, at the same time as he started to tell us, I am a boy.
So this is going on, but then let's do what your book does. Alternate between Jacob's story and yours. A child of an ultra-Orthodox American Jewish mother, you and your brother live with her in an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic community. What does that mean?
Well, primarily it means that every aspect of life is dictated from the moment you get up to the moment you go to bed. It also means that your clothing and your aspect and your demeanor as a woman in particular had to be modest.
Covered. Long sleeves, long skirts. Yeah.
Relationships between men and women or boys and girls who were not blood relatives, like brother and sister, were forbidden.
Very little of the outside world, newspapers, TV, anything like that. Your mother sneaks a little because she's a brilliant woman.
She got her PhD at BU and she taught at Rockland Community College in Muncie, New York.
So she sneaks some intellectual things in, yeah. but mainly she builds a wall around you mm-hmm. and your brother of what she thinks is protection. You are also showing signs of being so intelligent and wanting to succeed. So you're going to be the best Orthodox Jewish girl around. You get into high-level school in London, Gateshead, and yet we feel your yearnings. You sneak away to go to the library. Now we cut back to Jacob, who in your storyline you still believe is your daughter, struggling to make you see that he's not. You know, your child mirroring some of your childhood.
In the actual story, the feeling of deja vu began to creep up on me when I started to think about the word transgender and that it might possibly apply to my child. I think before that, I was grasping at straws. I was thinking, oh, this is a middle child, wants to be different than his sisters, or possibly this is some kind of compulsive disorder.
And again, you're saying his now out of respect for Jacob.
Exactly. But the person at the time who I knew as a girl. Yeah. And when I write the book, I use a pseudonym that Jacob and I picked together, which is M. And with his permission, in order to carry the reader along in real time, I do use the pronoun she until the moment of transition.
Right. Just before it does, though, it starts to get really serious with Jacob. Mm-hmm. You're worried something horrendous is going to happen. We flash back to your childhood. You're a teenager. Mm-hmm. You're betrothed to a young man you hardly know. He betrays you. You cut yourself. You harm yourself.
I was angry at myself because I think what happened over the years that I was in this community is that I began to believe that other people were right about the place that they thought women had in our society and what God designed for a woman to do, which is what I was told. So if these things felt wrong for me, if I wanted more from life, there had to be something wrong with me.
I mean, what insight that I think I'm hearing ultimately gives you
Absolutely.
Into what you thought was your daughter, trying so hard to be what everyone else expected of her at that point. And there's a moment that's just breathtaking where you're informed of the statistics about transgender children and how many kill themselves.
Well, it's at that moment that I realized how serious it was and went for help for the first time from an expert. All of a sudden, it's not so much, you know, can we get through to the next month without any trouble at school? What can I do to make my child happier today? It was, what can I do to keep my child alive? We did hear at the time, because the protocol had not shifted yet, that we could go through what was called watchful waiting, that we could kind of follow Jacob's lead. But at that point, I think M had lost her courage in some sense. Like, she had gotten signals from us and from people at school that she was expected to be a girl. She was giving up. Yeah. She was closing down.
Yeah. When this hit you, you write, "Suddenly all my bright dreams for her hit a brick wall. There will be no high school dances, no first loves, no prom, no college graduation, no watching her walk down the aisle if she doesn't make it past this moment. The dreams of my motherhood have collapsed to a single intent, keeping my child alive. There's nothing else."
Absolutely.
When you all, with help, start to allow, I mean, there's a name-picking thing, and it's suddenly we have Jacob, a new school.
Yeah.
What did you see in him?
I saw a miracle unfolding. I saw a child whose soul, whose spirit, if you believe in these things, had been shriveling, come to life. He was open to the world in a new way. He was showing affection to us again. He was happy. He was singing. I heard him giggle for the first time without restraint. I got my child back. And I didn't know beforehand that that's what the result would be. I just hoped to make him a little happier.
Well, Mimi LeMay, you also got your faith back. Because after the pain of trying to be someone you weren't, you came back, went to school here, married a Catholic, nice guy named Joe.
Yeah, Irish Catholic.
Yep. But then there's a moment in the book where you tell of remembering the story of Isaac, who had two sons. One of them, Jacob, has to disguise himself as his brother Esau, wearing Esau's animal skins, in order to get his blind father's blessings, in order to be loved. You write, "In that moment, you realized you were as blind as Isaac. You couldn't see your own son behind his metaphorical animal skins."
Yeah.
And you're just, oh, wait a minute. If you'd stayed in that faith, God actually directed you away from the faith because your own son, Jacob, hidden in skins in an Orthodox faith, would never have survived.
Yes, exactly. And I think that moment to me broke open something that I'd been, you know, I had buried for years. When I discovered that my child might be transgender, it almost felt like God was taking my child. In hindsight, God was giving me the most beautiful gift, which is a child who is genuinely authentic and has taught me what it means to live an authentic life. But realizing that if you flip everything over, he couldn't have survived in the community of my childhood made me appreciate that I had to leave and that perhaps I was meant to leave and that this leaving was blessed too.
What do you tell other people who may be hanging on our every word?
So the American Medical Association, American Academy of Pediatrics have all come out to say, support your child. Support them from the beginning. They will tell you what they need. It's different than a stage. It's different than a preference. It's when they identify the deepest part of themselves, the part that they show to the world identifies as something different than their sex assigned at birth. It is stifling that can be very dangerous.
You are also here to tell them through this book it won't be easy because you had to grieve, and it's heartbreaking, the little girl you thought you had.
Yes, there was a period of grief, and it's important, especially with young children, to let them know that you may be adjusting, but you aren't sad because they became who they truly are and are now actualizing their potential, but that you have some attachment to some old memories that might be difficult to let go.
And you and your mom have made up.
She loves her grandson and is actually doing a fabulous job of adjusting, given that she's still very faithful. And one of the messages of my book is that you don't need to choose between faith and acceptance. We just have to ask ourselves, are the things that we're taking out of our faith, do they match the humanity that we are seeing in front of us when we look at a trans person, when we look at a non-binary person or a gay and lesbian person? You can believe in God. You can be a person of faith and love every person who comes before you.
That's Mimi LeMay. Her book is What We Will Become, A Mother, A Son, and A Journey of Transformation for Both. Mimi, just terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
When a whale dies in the ocean and its body falls down to the seabed, something amazing happens.
When they hit that deep sea floor, it's like Thanksgiving.
Whale Falls, the science of a deep sea feast. This week on Shortwave, the Daily Science podcast from NPR.
Turkey's President Erdogan will meet with President Trump next week in Washington. It could be awkward. Lawmakers from both U.S. parties are preparing sanctions against Turkey for its incursion into northern Syria against Kurdish fighters who were once loyal to the U.S. But President Trump essentially gave Turkey the green light for that incursion, and the White House opposes any efforts to put sanctions on Turkey. Meanwhile, as Turkish troops continue to establish a so-called safe zone in northeastern Syria to push Kurds out of the region, civilians on both sides of the border are relieved that mortar and rocket attacks have stopped. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more on The View from two Turkish border towns.
Akçakale sits right on the Turkey-Syria border. On the other side, beyond the M4 highway, sits the Syrian city of Raqqa. There's a tea house on the Turkish side, just a few dozen yards from the border. As men watch news about the latest on the ceasefire between the army and Kurdish militants, large Turkish military trucks roll by on their way to cross into Syria. The owner, Mustafa, would rather not give his last name if he's going to be quoted in the media. He says he's 67 or 68 and has lived here most of his life. He says this fighting has been pretty bad, including attacks launched in violation of the recent ceasefire. But it was worse 7 years ago when it was ISIS on the other side.
Five women died in total. It was really bad. Now this time a couple of kids have died. It's awful. If I could, I would fight the Kurds myself, because as long as they stay there and they're used by international forces like the U.S., we're not going to be safe.
At the next table, a group of men play a game with numbered plastic tiles called OK. Mustafa says even though there's no guarantee hostilities won't start up again, the town is repopulating.
We were scared, of course, but everyone came back, and the kids came back too, and now the schools are open again. Now we're waiting to see what will happen.
With the Kurdish fighters' move away from the border zone, Russian and Turkish officials launched joint patrols. The patrols are the latest and strongest sign that when it comes to Syria, Russia is moving in where the U.S. moved out. Down the road, in a barbershop in the town of Suruç, a local farmer is getting a trim. His name is Ramazan Arda, and he says the shift in superpower involvement hasn't gone unnoticed. He asks, Russia's looking a lot more sincere than the U.S. at the moment, don't you think? Before adding that even though the border is so close, they don't go near it these days. Arda accepts the Turkish government's contention that Syrian and Turkish Kurdish fighters are cut from the same cloth. He says he's long been worried about a Kurdish state being carved out in this part of Turkey. We've been living here three generations, he says, and it always seemed they were going to form a state in here, like Israel, and that wouldn't be good for Turkey. For the time being, the chances of that happening appear slim, and people on this side of the border seem to be enjoying a relative moment of peace. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Suruç, Turkey.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a special Afrobeat edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Rich Medina is a DJ and host of the Jumpin' Funk Afrobeat Dance Parties. He joins us from Philadelphia. Hi, Rich.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. And we had you on the show several years ago, but you are back. And we should say that we are talking here about Afrobeat, not Afrobeats, which is a distinct genre. What is the difference?
Afrobeat is a musical styling and a drum programming styling created by Fela Nicolapo Kuti and Tony Allen when they were together with the Africa 70 band in Lagos in the late 1960s, early 1970s phase of Fela Kuti's career. Afrobeats, on the other hand, is music coming from very young African artists across the continent. A great deal of times that music is presented in pop form, but with a sensitivity to their own regional sonic diaspora.
Okay, well, sticking with the singular Afrobeat, let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is Progress by Tony Allen. Now, you mentioned Tony Allen is one of the founders of the genre. Tell us more about him.
So the song we just heard, Progress, is Tony Allen, who was the drummer for Fela Kuti's Africa 70 band. And together, they came up with the very signature drum programming disposition with a repetitive snare, repetitive kick drum patterns that are very distinct to Afrobeat. In the song Progress, that is Tony Allen leading the Africa 70 band from his drum kit. As a matter of fact, the saxophone solo that we were hearing in the beginning of the snippet that you just played is Fela. So it's Fela taking a back seat to his primary sideman and allowing him to lead the way with his own songwriting and disposition about how the composition should go.
And a political message in this song.
And completely political, completely social message, just like 95% of the records that you always hear from Fela, whether it's with Kula Lobitos, Africa 70, Egypt 80, or any of the other iterations of his musical presentation.
Okay, well, the next one we have is Filibuster XXX. This is by Antti Balas. This song is more than 11 minutes long. Is that why they call it filibuster?
Fantastic question. That could very well have something to do with it, but I, in the spirit of why we're talking today, a vast majority of Fela's compositions are well over 11 minutes, mm-hmm. and you won't hear any vocal presentation until post the first 50% of the record. Huh. So that idea of certain instrumentalists in the band or vocalists in the band getting an opportunity to stretch out across the song, it provides an interesting space of fairness to the musicians in the band where everybody, almost everybody, gets a chance to do some manner of showcasing within the tune before the verbal message of the tune gets presented.
And Antti Balas, by the way, is based in Brooklyn. Are there a lot of American-based Afrobeat bands?
There are indeed a great deal of American, Canadian, European, African, Asian bands that have carried on the tradition that Fela and Tony Allen started. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, speaking of carrying on the tradition of Fela, let's listen to the next one, which is by Shun Kuti, the son of Fela Kuti. This is called Na Oil. Your father and mother, they make you pull you together. They bring you for this world. You self started to grow. You go school to read book. You no even go to school. You dey use your own sense. As original African man, you dey use your talent. Working hard, you go enjoy. Anything what you do for yourself, it dey give them headache. Try your best to my brother. It might them not to satisfy. Please just be better, my brother. That one I keep skin pain. Tell us about this one.
So, Na Oil is a song talking about all the turmoil that big oil has brought to the black community across West Africa and Africa as a continent as a whole, and how elders dealt with it when it was presented to them, and how they taught their children how to deal with it, and how generation for generation we're here still dealing with swimming in oily water or the fallout of the debris that they leave behind. And more often than not, they leave that debris where black folks live, which is on the fringes of where the big finance of cities like Lagos have been so highly affected by the negative side of big oil.
If you were to go out in Lagos, Nigeria today, are a lot of the clubs still playing Afrobeat?
I believe that the Africa Shrine, Fela's club, which is now run by his son Femi and his daughter Yenny and Shion, I believe that that is ground zero for Afrobeat in Lagos. I don't have enough personal experience in the city or the country to speak for how widespread it is or not, but I do know that the music is still there and Fela's legacy stands strong as a voice that has always spoken out for the people against the system, whether that's a military system, whether that's a colonial system, whether that's a government system, or the combination of the three.
Okay, well, the last one that we have time for is the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. This is Sankofa. This one almost sounds like it could be a marching band in New Orleans or something like that.
Very interesting you should say that. So the Hypnotic Brass Band is actually a group of brothers, blood brothers, who are from New Orleans.
There you go.
And who was taught by their father, who was a prominent two-line musician in New Orleans. And that is exactly what you're hearing, is an Americanized brass band approach to African harmony, African melody that doesn't very often get spoken on.
Would you say that there's a general, even though there are political messages and sometimes there are sad political messages, that there's a general feel-good vibe coming from Afrobeat music?
Well, yeah. I mean, and it has a similar disposition as gospel in that sense. You know, you have people who have been held down who are looking for upliftment. Mm-hmm. And we do that through worship. We do that through music. We do that through the opportunity to gather together and really speak our minds. And music has been, it goes without saying, the vehicle. So this is an homage to Africa and a reflection of the local American disposition in New Orleans about how we celebrate death, how we celebrate life, and the way we choose to worship. Sometimes we're speaking to God, sometimes we're speaking against the system. Either way, we're looking for a little bit more sunshine than we saw yesterday.
That is Rich Medina, DJ and Afrobeat expert, hosts the Jumpin' Funk Afrobeat dance parties. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Another big city in the West is getting pushback on its attempt to address homelessness. Yesterday, the Las Vegas City Council voted to approve a ban on homeless camping, one with a caveat, though. People can't legally sleep on downtown streets if there are shelter beds available. Last night's meeting was contentious. Opponents chanted inside the council chambers against what they call the war on the poor. Some people were thrown out of that meeting. Joe Shaneman is a senior producer and host at KNPR, Nevada Public Radio. Joe, we know this is just one of many attempts over the past few decades in Las Vegas to do something about homelessness. But flesh out this new ban for us. What happens if the police are called on someone who's sleeping on the streets?
So if the police show up and there is shelter available, they will give the people the option to go to the shelter or to move out of the downtown area into other parts of the area that aren't under this this new law and camp there, I guess. If they refuse, they can be arrested and fined up to $1,000 and put in jail.
Okay. Well, how bad is it, you know, to prompt this move? And by the way, we're not talking about the Las Vegas Strip. We're talking about the downtown area. But how bad is it?
You know, it seems to have gotten worse. Only it's always been sort of bad, but it's gotten worse as the downtown has gentrified. Many, many more businesses are in the downtown area. A lot of these areas you would not go into just 3 years ago have new businesses, bars and restaurants. And the business community is very upset about it. There are people that businesses that have moved out of office complexes because the employees worry when they're at a stoplight that they might be attacked by some of the homeless people who are at these stoplights, you know, begging for money.
Yeah. The D.C.-based National Coalition for the Homeless named Vegas number one on its list of meanest cities. This was in 2003. So this is a problem that's been ongoing, meanest city in the way that it treats the homeless. Is it a magnet? Are these people who come to the city, people who live in the city or lose their housing? Who are these people?
Yeah, it is kind of a magnet because the weather here. I mean, if you can withstand the summer where it gets very hot, the rest of the year, it's pretty mild. But the affordable housing issue has made things much worse in the last 2 years. The rent here is astronomical. The price of homes is almost up to the same level that it was during the boom in the mid-2000s. So a lot of the people who are homeless are working, and a lot of people here live, you know, the homeless are everywhere. They live in the flood channels under the city, dozens, maybe hundreds of them. And most years, one, two, a few of them drown when we get flash floods.
Oh, terrible.
The thing the city really is kind of worried about is a lot of the very serious mental issues playing out among the homeless people. And mental health care in Nevada is ranked as 51st in the country. That is also a very big part of this yeah. issue.
Well, Clark County, which isn't Las Vegas, but oversees the Vegas Strip and the airport, they say the better solution is to come up with housing. But your city council voted 5-2 in favor of this ban, and we reached out to one of the council members, Councilwoman Victoria Seaman, and she sent us a statement that it's wanting to help the homeless. In fact, try to reach them and give them the tools to get someplace better than, you know, living in the downtown area where they are sleeping, defecating, urinating in doorways. You know, it has a negative impact on the area, but also we want to give them the tools to be somewhere else. Is there confidence that there will be any kind of shelter space for these people?
Not a lot of confidence. The number of homeless way outnumbers the number of beds, as they say, in the various shelters. But the city has said that, and I do believe Mayor Carolyn Goodman's heart is in the right place. She does say part of the reason they want to put them in the shelters is because then they can get them the services that they need, whether that be mental health, maybe vouchers to go live somewhere in a hotel for a while, just to help them get a job maybe. So that really seems to be the main push here. Again, also the main push is to move them out of the downtown area. And as I said, there is a downtown area where there will be banned. Also residential areas, but beyond that, if they move out of those areas, they will not be threatened with arrest or fines.
Well, but then someone else might consider them a problem somewhere else.
That's exactly what will happen.
Boise, Idaho tried to enforce a similar law to address homelessness, but it was struck down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last year. It was called unconstitutional. What's the sense of what happens with this law?
They studied that law very carefully. The difference with this one is they're offering them open shelter if it's available. If shelter is not available, the police cannot arrest them. And again, this doesn't begin until next year. There's going to be sort of this couple months period where they will be trying it out.
That's Joe Shaneman, senior producer and host at KNPR in Las Vegas. Joe, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. As the impeachment inquiry plays out in Washington, we'll talk with a group of high school students in Oklahoma who are quite interested.
We as citizens have the right to know what our president is doing and how it's affecting us on a day-to-day basis.
We'll ask about impeachment, voting, and where they get their news next time on Here and Now.